We're starting the Arachayim Parshas Vayeshev. And this week I wanted to share a bunch of Arachayims that are primarily chat-oriented, that really just address some basic questions in the story of Yosef and his brothers. There's one Arachayim in particular that we'll see together, which is more of an overarching Hashkafic or Arachayim. But again, the majority of what we're going to talk about tonight is more Arachayim in his role as a Pashtun, just someone who's interpreting the simple pshat in Pesukim. The first question which bothers the Arachayim, or that we'll discuss, and that bothers the Arachayim, is on page Kuf Pei Gimel in the Arachayim, on the very, on the second Pasuk in the Parsha. Ela told us Yaakov, Yosef ben Shvas Reishana Hoya, Rola Esechov Batsom. Yosef, at the age of 17, was a shepherd with his brothers watching over the sheep. Somewhat unusual that the Torah bothers to tell us Yosef's age. I mean, we do find ages occasionally in Chumash, but most of the ages which are revealed to us about, you know, the Avos and their various lives really come to us from Chazal, or, you know, when somebody passes away, the Chumash will tell us, you know, the sum total of his earthly years. Somewhat unusual that the Torah will stop in the middle of a story and tell us, by the way, the protagonist happens to be XYZ years old at this time. Why start off? And here it's told to us right at the beginning. Yosef was 17 years old. You know, why emphasize his being 17 when the story begins? So that's where Arachayim takes up that question. Ben Shvayesre, it's the next to last paragraph on the left on Kuf Pei Gimel. Tam Shotzrach L'spar Shnei Yosef, why does the Pasuk have to tell us how old Yosef was? Yiskavi L'odia Omram Zal Maseches Brachos L'olam Yitzater Odom L'chalom Tov Archof Beis Shana. Right, so the reason that the Torah bothers to tell us this information is to confirm or to teach us the idea which is taught in Masechta Brachos. At the end of Masechta Brachos, as we know, in the ninth parak, there's a whole section dealing with chalomos, with dreams and the interpretation of dreams. And there it says that a person, when he has a dream, shouldn't necessarily anticipate that the dream is going to be fulfilled right away. Sometimes you may have to wait as long as 22 years for the fulfillment of a dream. Because, after all, Yosef dreamt these dreams, and they weren't actually fulfilled until 22 years later. Meaning what? Meaning he dreamt that his father and his brothers would come and bow down before him, right? If you do the math, so Yosef was 17 when he was sold, as is told to us here in the Chumash. He's 30. The Chumash is going to tell us later on. It's another example where the Chumash shares with us his age. He's 30 when he's brought out of prison and stands before Paro and tells him, guess what, there are going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And the Chumash itself tells us that when Yosef's brothers come down, it's 2 years into the years of famine. Kizesh nosayim harav bekerav ha'aretz. Right? Yosef says to his brothers, when they come down, he finally reveals himself, by the way, the famine has been on for 2 years. So in other words, from the time that he stands before Paro, it's a sum total of 9 years until he sees his brothers and his father, and they bow down before him. Right? So basically, from the time that he's 17 until the time that he's 39, 22 years elapse. So the dream that he dreamt at 17 wasn't fulfilled till he was 39, says the Gemara. So you see, a dream can sometimes take 22 years before it's actually fulfilled. Don't despair. Some dreams, you know, just take a while. The Imkain, in Lo Hayom Odia Kosu Ben Yitzayin Shon, Lo Ayino Yodimze. Right? And clearly, says the Arachayim, had the Torah not shared with us the fact that Yosef was 17, we wouldn't be able to figure out this important, quasi-halachic teaching, you know, that sometimes you may have to wait 22 years for a dream to be fulfilled. So, that's the reason that the age of Yosef is given. By the way, although the Arachayim doesn't say it explicitly, that also answers why Yosef's age is given as 30 when he stands before Paro, because that's all part of the same cheshbon. How do we know how long he was down in Mitzrayim? I mean, it's only by adding up 17 to 30, and then figuring out that it was another 9 years, as is also pretty much explicit in the Chumash, you know, until the brothers and his father actually come down to Mitzrayim and bow down before him, as is mentioned in the dream. Right? So that's one interpretation the Arachayim gives that, you know, these numbers are important benchmarks in order to derive a halachic principle. Yeah.
How do you attach holdos?
Yeah, so that's a whole discussion. The Rakhan actually has a little bit earlier, but you can take a look if you want on Toldos. But then the Rakhan gives a second shot. Al Yirtze Al Derech Omron the Gemara Hayda Adifna Mechavroi Dinasifna B'Shitza. Gemara quotes one of the Amoraim is saying in Kiddushin, you know why I'm better off than my friends, because they all got married at 17 and I got married at the age of 16. The age of 16, Baruch Hashem, you know, I didn't have such a Yetzirah yet, so by getting married at 16, I was able to be a little bit more settled. They waited the extra year until they were 17. Their passions and their emotions were seething, and even though they got married, you know, which is supposed to help a person control his passions and his emotions, but they had that extra year of youthful ferment, so Mimela, you know, they turned out to be not as good as me, you know, in terms of being able to control my passions and my emotions. Hareki b'shitzar, lo yiskaber achomer v'yitzara al ha'odim ko b'shitzar. Right, so the Gemara is basically saying that 16 and 17 are very crucial years in a person's development, that one year can make all the difference. At 16, a person is still kind of perhaps mellow, and one might even say somewhat innocent, but by the time the person makes it to 17, the person already has a hiskabrus, has an increase in his yetzer hara, in his desire for material things, in his desire for sensual pleasures, and you know that year really makes all of the difference. That's the role what the Torah hopes to do by teaching us that at the outset of the story that Yosef was 17. It's interesting. You know, it's not just that the Torah tells us that Yosef was 17. The very first thing the Torah tells us about Yosef is that he was 17. Right? In other words, that's the most important thing we need to know about Yosef before we even get started with the story. Why? So says the Arachayim, because the fact that he was 17 plays a very big role in the story. Ki be'emtzos ha'gos ha'zman hayo botzad tigvores enoshis l'hisgaros be'echov u'lahavi dibasam ra'a. It's because of his age that he acted in the way he did, says the Arachayim, because we know that a person at 17 is very easily stirred by emotions and passions of things of that nature. That's what motivated him. Again, Chazal tells us that, or the Pasuk really tells us, but Chazal elaborate on it, that Yosef tattletailed on his brothers back to his father, right? And he got them all wound up against him, which eventually led to his sale. The Arachayim implies that a person at a different stage in life might not have done that. Part of, you know, that was not, in hindsight, that was not the smartest thing for Yosef to have done. To have gone back to his father with all kinds of tales about what his brothers were doing or weren't doing or whatever, you know, which ultimately incited them against him. How can you account for Yosef's behavior? So says the Arachayim, very simple. He was 17. It's a fascinating insight. You know, the teenage years, you know, are not just a modern phenomena. The teenage years, according to the Arachayim, or at least the notion of, you know, the 17-year-old, and the unique challenges that come with being a 17-year-old are things that go back to the Gemara, and according to the Arachayim, to the Chumash itself. You can understand the story of Yosef because he was an impetuous 17-year-old, and that had a lot to do with the way that he acted. If you got up and said that today, you'd get in a lot of trouble. Right? But that's the Arachayim basically says.
You have the height of sibling rivalry as well?
Perhaps. I don't know if he's saying so much in terms of sibling rivalry, but the Arachayim seems to be saying, you know, that there's a certain rashness, you know, that comes with being 17, that a more level-headed Yosef might have acted differently, but because he was 17, he was sort of carefree. You know, we know, I mean, we know this ad hayom, you know, how come you know, the 17-year-old is probably the most dangerous person to put behind the wheel of a car? Right? Because the 17-year-old thinks he's invincible. I can drive however I want, whenever I want, wherever I want, however fast I want, and I'm invincible. I'm immortal. You know, nothing is going to happen to me. To some extent, that might have been a similar kind of attitude that Yosef had. I'll go and tattletale on my brothers to my father, but nothing's going to happen to me because, you know, that's just part of being 17.
Was it a German passage that was different back then?
So it's interesting. I mean, I would have thought so, and I still think so to some extent. Meaning, you know, at in your middle teens, oftentimes you were married. You know, by certainly during large stretches of history. That's why I find it so fascinating that the Arachayim is basically describing a phenomena which we still can recognize in teens today, right? So the truth is, this concept is tremendous on so many levels, because, you know, when we deal with troubled teenagers today, the observation that a 17-year-old is a very difficult animal to deal with, so to speak, is something that hasn't changed since the days of the Arachayim, and indeed since the days of Yosef HaTzadik. And essentially, the Arachayim is telling us, even a Yosef HaTzadik was a tough kid at 17. 17 was a tough age, even for somebody who's one of the tzaddikim, you know, who's ultimately going to be a major, major figure in Klal Yisrael. Al-Achas Kamav Kamav should be a chizik to anyone who's either dealing with 17-year-olds or to someone who's a 17-year-old himself, right? We know it's a tough time. Yosef HaTzadik had a tough time when he was 17. And a lot of the Mechiras Yosef stems from the fact that he was a 17-year-old going through teenage angst, so to speak, right? And yet, so if a Yosef HaTzadik could struggle with those kind of issues, we have to be extra special sensitive to those people, you know, our own contemporary 17-year-olds who are dealing with those kinds of issues, and realize that it's not so poshut. But there's a glimmer of hope. Because here, the Arachayim has not addressed another question, which is first Pshat does address. Why is it important for the Chumash to mention that Yosef was 30 when he stood before Paro? Right? Again, in the previous Pshat of the Arachayim, that the whole point of mentioning the ages is to try to figure out how long you can defer a dream and not necessarily see it's coming to fruition. All right, so we need the benchmark. So if he was 17, then he was 30, and then it was 9 years after that. So from 17 to 39, it was 22 years. But if you hold, like the second chat, that Yosef's being a 17-year-old is important just to understand the story, that you have to understand this is a kid who's a teenager who's acting up, and that you know, there's certain things which, you know, just happened because he's a 17-year-old. So then what's the role of the Chumash telling us by the time he gets to Paro, he's 30? And I think the answer is that the Chumash is trying to depict, again, al-derech the Arachayim, the Chumash is trying to depict the fact that Yosef matures. In other words, Yosef at 30 is a totally different person from who Yosef is at 17. Yosef at 17 is incredibly self-confident. You know, he thinks he rules the world. He goes to his father, he tattletales on his brothers, he doesn't even bother finding out the story. They're eating Aver Menachai, and you know, he tells them all this kind of stuff. And when Yosef stands before Paro at 30, one of the things that's striking about Yosef's conversation with Paro is how dependent on God Yosef depicts himself as being.
Jail matured him.
Right. Jail matured him, age matured him.
Sales.
Right. What's that for? Sales matured him. Right. In other words, Yosef went through a lot. And that, you know, going through these terrible experiences that nobody should voluntarily ever have to go through, that took this kind of rash 17-year-old and made him into an incredibly thoughtful, religious, pious man of 30 who was able to rise to be the second in command in Egypt and ultimately solve the world's problems and make up with those very same brothers that he'd had problems with. So in a sense, this is a message of hope for teens at risk. I mean, it's nothing short of that. In other words, you can start off as a brash 17-year-old, but, you know, you can turn into a very mature, thoughtful, and, you know, incredibly you know, religiously powerful and spiritually significant 30-year-old. Watch the evolution of Yosef HaTzadik, you know, because his ages, unlike the other, you know, characters we've met before in Chumash Reishis, as Avraham Avinu, alright, we kind of get the sense that he's always Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Yosef has a real evolution here, a real transformation of character, and the ages are crucial to really plotting how he becomes a different person as time moves on.
Yosef's behavior can be explained at that immature 17-year-old.
You know, Chinam, right? The question is, right, if Yosef, we could explain away Yosef as being a 17-year-old who didn't know what he was doing, right? But the brothers are considerably older than that. You know, certainly the older brothers, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, right? How do you explain away their approach? And I think, unfortunately, the answer is, look, not all misdeeds can be explained away by age, right? There are plenty of immature older people who are out there as well. But, you know, a 17-year-old can get under the skin of even a mature individual, right? And that's what happens with the brothers over here, right? The fact, you know, we're not letting the brothers off the hook because they were older.
No, it's a comment.
Right. Right. In a sense, you could say, okay, he was 17. They should have known better. No, they were older, right? We're going to talk a little bit, one of the things the Archaim is going to try to explore over here is the behavior of the brothers. Just, I mean, okay, you don't like your kid brother, but throwing him into a pit, trying to kill him, you know, all this kind of stuff is a little over the top, you know? So how do you understand that on any level and still reconcile that with our image of the Shmatim as being tzaddikim?
The thing is, you know, as recently as, let's say, a couple of years ago, when we had a great Rav this year, and when we had a great Tom, you know, there were so many biographies of them, and we don't see anywhere that they were anything, that any one of them, of Rav Moshe's contemporaries, you know, the were anything but amazingly, you know, precocious.
Right, so
even at a much younger age.
So the question is, in other words, we read biographies of Gedolim, and they seem to be extraordinarily and supernaturally precocious, even at young age. Like at young ages, could be. It could be that that's more of a comment on the biographies than it is on the lives of these tzaddikim. You know, there's a beautiful letter from Rav Hutner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. This is actually printed in the collected letters of Rav Hutner, the Igros Uksavim of the Pachad Yitzchak. Where he writes, again, we don't have the letter that was written to him, but he writes to obviously a Talmud or someone who was close to him, who was struggling with religious ups and downs, and he writes to him, do you think that the Chafetz Chaim was born the Chafetz Chaim? You don't think the Chafetz Chaim had to go through many, many personal religious struggles before he became the Chafetz Chaim? You think he just kind of popped out? Oh, here I am, Chafetz Chaim. You know, you don't think he had nisyonos to speak Lashon Hara many, many times that he wrestled with and he grappled with before he ultimately became a Chafetz Chaim? Right? The implication is that, yeah, I mean, you know, a person who struggled tremendously. I mentioned, I was talking to the women a couple of weeks ago, so I mentioned that one of the biographies that's out recently, which I actually drew a lot of personal inspiration from, was the recently published biography of Rav Mordechai Gifter, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Because basically Rav Gifter was an American boy who was raised in a home which, to be honest, I'm not even sure. I mean, the biography kind of is delicate on this point. I'm not sure if his parents were Shomer Shabbos necessarily. I mean, they certainly were not the picture of, you know, Gaonim, Tzaddikim, you know, all the things that we normally associate with things. He came to MTA as a 13-year-old. He was a public school child in Baltimore. He was sent up to MTA in New York at the age of 13 to go to high school. For his entrance exam into MTA, he proudly revealed the fact that he had learned one block Gemara. Right? And basically he got admitted to MTA, they put him in the lowest of the classes, and he worked very hard, and he became Rav Gifter. Right? And, you know, the truth is, there's a lot of inspiration in a story like that, you know, and again, you know, the biography doesn't feel the need to go into his early childhood, you know, I think that's, you know, there's necessarily a point in that, but I assume he was an all-American boy, you know, growing up first in Virginia and then in Baltimore afterwards. And somebody like that can become an Adam Gadol B'Yisrael. In a sense, that's the lesson of the Yosef story. You know, you can Taka Yosef is a 17-year-old. Was a tough kid. You know, he had certain things that stemmed from the fact that he was 17. And again, as the Aruch Hayim says, there's a natural tendency when you're 17 to rebel against authority, to start up with your brothers, you know, to have all these kinds of things. And the story of Yosef is how he basically matures and becomes an Adam Gadol Me'od over the course of his life. Yeah.
Yosef's sojourn for 22 years in prison,
He wasn't 22 years in prison. Right? In other words, 22 years away from his father. Right? It was from 30 to 39. He was already ruler in Mitzrayim. Right? But again, yeah. But he certainly spent time in prison. No question. Yeah.
So, how did he retain?
Look, first of all, how did he retain his faith in God in prison? First of all, there was a minion and a daf yomi in the prison. Right? Probably. Probably, right? But, you know, I think that's mamish part of the story. You know, the Gemara in Sotza tells a very famous story about Yosef HaTzadik, that when he's, you know, in the house of Potiphar, he's being tempted by Ishus Potiphar, so he almost gives in, and then he sees the image of his father's face in the window, and he just says, you know, I can't do this, right? You can never really know, but I think one can possibly suggest that that was really just a turning point in the life of Yosef HaTzadik. In other words, all of a sudden, now he just has to stand up there and say, okay, what am I really all about? And having the image of his father and his father's teaching and, you know, all of that, you know, just made it click for him and gave him the sense of bitachon and the ribono shel olam, which was palpable. And that sense of bitachon, you know, and that commitment kept him going through prison and ultimately helped shape him into the Gadol B'Yisrael that he became. You know, but I think that's part of the read of the story. That's what the Aruch Chaim is telling us over here. The story of Yosef is a story in part of maturation. You know, that he's not born, you know, Yosef HaTzadik. He sort of grows into that role. I don't want to portray Yosef as a kid at risk who's hanging out on the street corners and the like, you know. I mean, Chazal tells us Yaakov sat with Yosef and he taught him the Torah that he learned from Shem Ve'Eber. I mean, you know, he wasn't no good dick or anything like that. But yet, there was this side of Yosef that wasn't mature, meaning a more mature person would have looked at that situation and would have said, you know what, maybe I should think twice before I go back to my father. You know, maybe there's another way of looking at this. Maybe there's another way of dealing with this. Maybe just going and tattletaling to my father and what my brothers are doing is not the smartest thing to do. Now, a person gets older, they have more yeshiva hadas, and they can analyze the situation with greater maturity. Again, there was maybe a lack of judgment here on the part of Yosef that was the kind of lack of judgment that typifies a 17-year-old, and he matures as he gets a little bit older. Okay. Yeah.
You could say that his lack of judgment in that maybe it helps to explain the rashness of the brothers, that they overreacted
Perhaps we'll see the Archon in a little bit is going to talk about the brothers and their reaction and how to try to understand that. Let's take a look a little bit further, Kuf Pei Hei, on the right hand column, Pasuk Hei, Vayachalom Yosef. So Tzarech Lodas, another question I asked the Archon, just to get him trapped. You have to try to understand, Loma Hay Yosef Magdil Hasina. How do you understand Yosef sharing the dreams with his brothers? Now again, based on what we just said, you might just say, well, that was part of his rash personality, right? But you gotta wonder, you know, what does Yosef think how does Yosef think the brothers are gonna react? Guess what, guys? I just saw the most amazing thing last night. You and Dad just came, you know, and you bowed down in front of me. Isn't that awesome? Right? How did he think they were going to react? You think they were going to say, oh, Yosef, what a great idea. Why don't we do that? I mean, how oblivious was Yosef to what was going on around him? He didn't realize that the brothers hated him. I mean, it says already in Pasuk Daled, even before the Yosef tells the dreams to his brothers. Hayiru echov ki oso av aviyam mikol echov ayisnu oso. Lo yachud davra l'shalom. The brothers couldn't speak peaceably with him. They didn't have a good word to say to him. And this is before he tells them the dreams. So what does he think he's going to accomplish by telling them the dreams? So again, you might have said, well, that's exactly Yosef. That's his problem. You know, he wants to rub it in their faces that he's on top and they're going to come down to him. Now, interestingly, the Arachayim does not say that. Because as much as the Arachayim described a certain rashness on the part of Yosef, apparently the Arachayim felt that, you know, we're not talking about someone who's totally rash, right? Even Yosef at 17, the Arachayim seems to be saying, wouldn't have rubbed the brothers' faces in the fact that I'm going to be on top and you're going to be on bottom. The Arachayim can't imagine Yosef doing that. So there must have been some different kavana that Yosef had in sharing the dreams with his brothers. What was that exactly?
So I wanted to ask this. We know because Chazal tell us that Yosef's birth seemed to have provided a signal for Yaakov to move on from Laban, because with the birth of Yosef, there was the Esav was now going to be dealt with.
Right.
So the question I have is, did Yosef know this? And we know this, but was it known to the brothers of Yosef that that's his particular role? Because if so, he's now asserting his self-importance.
Oh, so that's an excellent question. As the question being, again, just once again for the benefit of the listening audience, right? Quick question from Charlie Corin, also a Levi. Is Yosef aware of the fact that his very existence is a counterbalance to Esav? In other words, did he learn Rashi in Parshas Vayetze, where it says that the birth of Yosef propelled Yaakov to go back there to Israel, because now he knew that Esav had met his match,
yes.
Right? So that's an excellent question. The Arachayim doesn't deal with that directly, but some of what he says may enable us to conjecture a little bit about that question. So we'll try to address that in a few moments, Bezer Hashem. Yeah.
Say that,
in other words, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, did the Nevuah of the Ris Ben HaBesarim, was that passed down to Yitzchak, to Yaakov? Did Yosef know that? It's a good question. I don't know. I would assume he probably did, but I don't know that for a fact.
I mean, did Yosef kind of figure that what he's saying is not Shuchbiyot? It must be in a Nevuah that he's got a default, whether the big brothers like it or not.
Right.
The Nevuah is something that he has to say. It can't be kept quiet. You can't be Kremish in Nevuah. Yosef must have thought that. He's got the demand from his father. He's got the Messiah. There must be something that there's going to come a situation, come a time where maybe himself did not climb, but there will come a time where he's going to be the leader. And then about that, so maybe he had to, because of the perspective of the son, this is all part of us.
Right. So the Ramban's basic mahalach, again, not the Arachayim, the Ramban's basic mahalach with the dreams is that the dreams are nevuos. And therefore, says the Ramban, that's why Yosef, you know, next week's parasha, you know, in Miketz, orchestrates elaborately trying to bring Binyamin and ultimately Yaakov down to Mitzrayim, because the dreams are nevuos, and the nevuos have to be fulfilled, and until all the brothers and Yaakov bow down to Yosef, the nevuah of the dreams is not going to be fulfilled. So that's what's motivating Yosef the whole time. You know, when he's going through all these machinations to bring Binyamin and then ultimately Yaakov down to Mitzrayim. That's the Ramban's mahalach, you know, in much of what's going on over here. So according to that mahalach, you know, that these are mamish nevuos, these are not just dreams, these are nevuos. So yeah, kovish nevuos, so he can't withhold the fact that he got this nevuah.
Maybe even a simpler fact is that he realized these were dreams. Mm-hmm. Being a 17-year-old and rash, he didn't really understand it, so he went to somebody who already
right.
Went to his father and said, Tati, explain it to me.
But he doesn't go to his father, he goes to his brothers. Right? So in other words, you know, he's not just asking for guidance from his father, what's going on over here. he's going to his brother. So that's very significant. Our Chaim says as follows. Our Chaim gets three pshatim over here. Bottom of the page, he says, or in that paragraph, he says, V'ulai, it's five lines from the bottom on page Kuf Behe, V'ulai ki niskavi lodi al som kim nashramayim ha'alulu l'mayla. Right? Maybe Yosef was trying to actually diffuse the hatred of the brothers as follows. He goes to the brothers and says, look, I got these dreams. These dreams are coming from Hashem. Right? Call them nevuos, call them whatnot, but these are divine messages. And these divine messages show that I'm supposed to be on top. I'm supposed to be the leader. Therefore, you see that Yaakov's favoritism towards me is actually in line with what God himself has in mind. The Heiner. Right? Why do the brothers hate Yosef? Because they see that Yaakov shows them special favoritism. So on his passive, you know, and I have a special chavrusa with Yosef. So Yosef sees this, and he thinks it over. He says, oh, you know how I can get them to like me? I'll explain to them that it's not just Yaakov, it's God. God made me on top. It's not just Yaakov Avinu. It was just Yaakov Avinu and Stam's sibling rivalry. But you know what? I'm appointed by God. So that will calm them down. Also. And if that's the case, once they realize, says Yosef, that I'm appointed by God to be the leader, so then they'll leave me alone. Now, we chuckle at that a little bit, because again, in hindsight, reading the story, we think, my, that was rather naive, you know, that does not seem to, that did not really work out all that well. But the truth is, you know, according to the Aruch Chaim's interpretation, Yosef has a tremendous sense of the frumkeit of his brothers. In other words, it's not naivete, although it may have turned out that way. Right? And Yosef, basically, if you would ask Yosef about his brothers, Yosef would say, my brothers are God-fearing men. And if they have a communication from God that indicates that I'm the leader, I'm confident that they'll accept that. His belief in his brothers is unbelievable. Right? I mean, his belief in his brothers is really quite extraordinary. Right? So, certainly relative to how they feel about him, but even under normal circumstances, meaning, you know, forget about Yosef and his brothers. If you tried to play this out in a modern day scenario where you have sibling rivalry, you know, the best way to get Reuven to like Shimon, you know, in modern day terms, is probably not to go to him and say, guess what? I had a dream last night from God that says that I'm supposed to be, you know, your superior in terms of the family, right? You know, in modern day terms, that doesn't really work all that well. Right? The fact that Yosef really honestly anticipates that that's going to get them to stop hating him means that he really has tremendous confidence in their frumkeit, right? And those, you know, it's not exactly what Charlie suggested before, namely that Yosef was aware of his special role as being the one who would counteract Esau, but it's similar. In other words, Yosef hopes by telling the dreams to his brothers to dafka diffuse their hatred, because I'm divinely appointed for this. It's not Yaakov's decision, it's not my decision, you know, can't we just all get along? You know, this is just not Rebbe Shalom picked me to be the leader. If he thought that there were such big tzaddikim, it's a good question. Why did he go to their father? Why go to their father and complain about what they were doing? Why not just approach them directly? I don't know. So it's a good question. It could be that Yosef felt, again, Yosef thought his brothers were such big tzaddikim that they would appreciate the reprimand of their father. In other words, they, you know, he didn't see himself as tattletaling. You know, he saw himself as giving constructive criticism through their father, who, after all, should know that his children are acting in such a way so that he can, in his role as father, you know, tell them the right way and steer them back on the right path. Now, again, you know, that may have been more imagined than anything else, but he does view his brothers in this very tremendously positive light.
It seems to me that Yaakov, throughout his whole life, has had issues throughout his family with favoritism.
Yeah.
With his parents, with his brother, with his wives. Why was it so important for him to show favoritism to Yosef?
Right. So you say, you know, how come Yaakov didn't learn you know, from the previous experiences and how come he, you know, decided to show favoritism to Yosef, we see where all of this ended up, right? So, the Gemara itself implies that, you know, that the Gemara itself talks about how Yaakov Avinu basically revisited the very same issue that that had been a problem for him. You know, perhaps one can suggest as follows. I mean, up until this time, the way Jewish history has played itself out is there's a certain brother who's chosen to carry on the Masorah, and everybody else, you know, is sort of on the outs, right? Yaakov may have thought that, okay, it was painful what I had to go through myself, but apparently this is the way it works. Not that everyone's going to be on the outs, but that, you know, there has to be one person who's clearly selected as being the leader. And, you know, that's been the paradigm up till now, and that's going to be the paradigm going forward.
The timing seems wrong. I mean, it's always chronological in those perceptions. Right after Yosef gives the evil reports, Yaakov gives him the blessing. I mean, was that the right time to show favoritism?
Unless you hold that, you know, why did Yaakov give the Ksonis Pasim right after the, you know, the tattletaling? So maybe from Yaakov Avinu's perspective, that's Dafka why I gave the Ksonis Pasim to Yosef. In other words, I see that you're doing what's right. I see that you're loyal. I see that you're, you know, trying to influence your brothers to do the right thing. You know, so you are worthy because of that, you know, to get the Ksonis Pasim. Again, you know, Monday morning quarterback, we can certainly say that maybe that wasn't the smartest thing to do, the best thing to do. But, you know, at the time, you know, it could be that Yaakov was even rewarding the loyalty and the devotion of Yosef in that way.
The mechanism is different. The experiences of Yaakov, both of Irma, that they were cleverly and intriguingly done with with Rachel Leah, with Esau. This is a dream.
Mm-hmm.
So the dream symbolism is that there's clearly an established leader, which is Yosef. And the dream symbolism is not involved in deceit or trickery or whatever. It's kind of it's harder to argue with. It's presented as this is a dream, and as the rabbi's been saying, the support of the Rabbanu Shel Olam in this dream. So the mechanism is different here in terms of, what Yosef's experience in contrast to Yaakov's experiences.
Right. No, I hear that. Let's see the next trial. Next trial is very similar. More pragmatic. He also wanted to try to diffuse their sinna, their hatred, but not thinking that there was such a big tzaddik, but he was being very pragmatic. He said, look, you know, God has revealed to me that you will need me at one day. You know, the day will come where you will need me. You will look up to me as being the leader. So leave me alone now. Don't mess with me now. Don't give me a hard time now, because the day will come where you will need me. Very pragmatic. Maybe they won't start up with me now, because I'm revealing to them my secret weapon that one day I'm going to be on top. So don't start with me, because I'll be forced to take my revenge. Because, once again, ki hashvatim yachufu roshon l'gzeras kel elyon ulamitzpiyeh, because he felt confident that the shvatim, the other brothers, with their tzidkus, would certainly give in to the divine decree. They would certainly believe him. You know, whether they liked it or not is another thing, but they would certainly believe him that he was destined to be on top, and they would therefore, you know, whatever they felt in their hearts, they would not do anything to harm him or to hurt him in any way because of their anticipation that he would rise to greatness. A third shot. Yechavei l'karev halavavos yachad. The idea of sharing the dreams with the brothers was actually to get them to like him more. How do you figure that one, right? You know, come, you know, hey guys, you know, you should love me so much. One day you're going to come and bow down to me. How do you figure that one? Gemara famously says in Perek HaRoah, the last Perek of Brachos, that ultimately dreams are ambiguous, and the way you interpret them, the way you interpret them is ultimately what decides how they're going to turn out. You take an ambiguous dream and you interpret it for good, it will be good. You take an ambiguous dream and you interpret it for evil, it will be evil. So what should you do when you have a dream, says the Gemara in Brachos? Go to someone you like and tell them the dream, because then they will give you a favorable interpretation and it will work out well. So says Yosef as follows. Yosef says, you know what? The Gemara says, right, you know, as we know, that when a person has a dream, you know, he should tell it to his friend. My very telling them the dream is a signal of friendship to them. Because they'll say to themselves, certainly he wouldn't tell us the dream if we hated him, because then we would interpret it in a bad fashion, and, you know, that would come out negatively. So the very fact, you know, the very notion of sharing dreams is a way of conveying subtly that I like you, I think you like me, I consider you to be a friend. Right? In other words, on our level, you know, a way in which we can appreciate it, oftentimes you want to create a friendship with somebody, or, you know, you want to indicate to somebody that you have a friendship with them, you open up to them. You know, when you confide something to somebody, that's usually a way of implicitly telling them, I think you're on my side. If I thought you didn't like me, I wouldn't confide in you. Right? So his confiding the dream in them is actually a way of trying to build their confidence in him. But it backfired. They hated him so much, and they were so jealous of him, that even though Yosef was well-intentioned, and under different circumstances, might even have been successful. In other words, his going to them was a way of saying, look, I love you, I want to be your friend, I want to be your brother, I want this relationship to work. They were so blinded by sinna and kinna that they could only interpret the dream as he's ruling over them. Now, this is very interesting, this last line of the Archaim, because we always, I think when we read the Chumash, we always read the Chumash something along the following lines. The dreams clearly indicate that Yosef was going to rule over his brothers, right? And when the brothers say, Hamaloch Timloch Aleinu, Imashal Timshal Banu, will you reign over us? Will you rule over us? They're just stating the obvious. I mean, that is what the dream means. And they're just, you know, angry at the fact that Yosef could be so rash as to present, you know, so obviously to them his visions that he's going to rule over them. But the Archaim here seems to be suggesting something a little bit different. The Archaim here seems to be suggesting that the dream didn't necessarily have to be interpreted that way. It doesn't say in the dream, you know, there's nothing in the dream itself that indicates that Yosef is going to rule over his brothers. They are going to come and bow down to him. Now, that could be an expression of they are subjugated to him, as the way that they interpret it. But that could be interpreted in a variety of other ways. I mean, maybe they're going to give thanks to him for some wonderful thing that he's going to do for them. Right? Maybe it's a bowing of gratitude. Maybe it's a bowing of respect, you know, but not of melucha, ramshala. Right? In other words, the way that the Or Haim suggests over here that the interpretation of the brothers was not necessarily muchrach. In other words, the dream didn't necessarily mean what the brothers interpreted to mean. Right? It could have been interpreted in a much more benign fashion than the brothers necessarily saw it as being. And their interpretation of it as being, you know, Yosef's dominion over them was a direct function of the tremendous hatred that they had for Yosef, that they could only see his dream as indicating that he wanted to lord over them in some way. But you don't necessarily have to read the dream that way. That's what the Archaim over here seems to be suggesting.
And what was the root of that hatred? Did they just jealousy?
They saw that Yaakov showed favoritism towards Yosef.
Yeah.
So they said, okay, if Yaakov shows favoritism towards Yosef, and Yosef is going and tattletailing on us, it must be that Yosef harbors these secret dreams of lording over us. Not necessarily. The dream doesn't necessarily mean that. The dream just says that they would bow down to him. You know, bowing down could mean a variety of different things, right? It doesn't necessarily have to indicate that they're servile, you know, to Yosef. And in a sense, the Archaim seems to be implying the fact that that's ultimately what does happen, you know, that Yosef is their leader, and they're bound down to him as the, you know, second in command in Egypt. To some extent, maybe they brought that on themselves by virtue of the idea that you know, that dreams follow the interpretation. The interpretation makes the dream in a certain sense.
Maybe this is a question of Vayigash, but the question I wanted to ask is, why is it important that later on, because you did mention it, that it's important for Yosef to make sure, it becomes important for Yosef to make sure that the dream is fulfilled, that he acts in a way to facilitate that the dream.
That's the Ramban. That's Ramban's understanding of the Chumash. I don't know that the Aruch Haim would necessarily agree with that. That's the Ramban's understanding of the Chumash, that all the machinations later on are all to make the dreams come true.
He's the only one who knows that, basically.
I mean, he's the one who says that. Akashi, you can certainly ask him that, is who says it's your job to make the Nevuos come true? I mean, you know, if Lamashal, if Yirmiyahu HaNavi sees the Nevuah that Yerushalayim is going to be destroyed, L'chari, he doesn't have to take a torch and throw it into the city, right? I mean, that's, you know, just because there's a Nevuah that you see something's going to happen doesn't mean you have to accelerate it happening, right? So that's a kasha on the Ramban. I don't know. But that's what the Ramban says. Yes. Yeah.
This is after all the Shiftei Koh.
Right.
And so this Sina just appears to grow to the point where they actively, consciously contemplate murder, and then with some intercession, it's kidnapping, which I think is found in Shmos, which you're not allowed to do. I mean, mind-boggling who these people are, and we spoke about who people are and who they become. How could this be? How could they contemplate murder and then say, well, if not murder, then we're going to have to put blood on our hands. We'll
kidnap. So that's an excellent segue into the next Aruch Haim, right? Clearly you're playing to the audience. Eish Kuf Tzadi. Aruch Haim on the left hand column, it's Pasuk Lamizayin, Paraglamizayin Pasuk Chav. In the middle, you know, in the left, top left hand column, the Aruch Haim asks the following question, right? Just, so fast forwarding to the Mechiras Yosef, Yom Toma. The million-dollar question by the Mechiras Yosef. If you'll ask me, Al mi samchu shiftei kol haroges hanefesh? You know, these are the shvatim tzadikim. You know, again, whatever flaws they may have had were certainly, you know, incredibly minor in nature. How can they contemplate killing their brother? I mean, forget about their brother. How can they contemplate killing anybody, let alone their brother? Umagam nefesh tzadik achiyim. I mean, certainly, you know, their brother, the tzadik Yosef. Like the Archaim earlier said that, you know, their original Eitzel was to kill him in a way that they wouldn't be chayav the dine Adam, that they would be exempt from a judicial punishment. The Archaim explains that when they say let us go and kill him, they're referencing a Gemara in Bava Kamma that when multiple people participate in the killing of a person, and you can't identify who the murderer is, actually they're all pater b'dinei adam. They're all exempt, you know, from the death penalty in Sanhedrin. So that's what they mean, l'chu v'nargeu, let's all do it together so we can get out of the death penalty. Great, that doesn't really give us a sense of confidence in the Shvatim. You know, here, let's go kill him and we'll do it, we'll find a legal loophole so we won't be held culpable for killing him. How do you understand that? I mean, in such a case, even if through a legal loophole they got out of, you know, being held liable on an earthly level, they're certainly culpable with Dinei Shamayim. God is going to hold them responsible. So how do you understand this? So he says the following. This is how you understand what the brothers were thinking. We know this halacha called Edim Zomimim. Edim Zomimim means that when a witness comes to Beis Din and gives testimony, and then two witnesses come to Beis Din and give testimony, and then subsequently two other witnesses come to Beis Din, they say, you couldn't have given that testimony. When you claim to have been there, you were actually with us, you know, 1,000 miles away, so you couldn't have been there. The halacha is that the first set of Edim become Edim Zomimim, scheming Edim, and they're punished in the same way that they sought to punish, that they sought to inflict punishment on the defendant. So perhaps the brothers saw Yosef as being an Edim Zomim. Ki matzinu shuhevi dibasam ra laviyam, for amat dvarashis haibu misa alay duso. Hahu amash ha'ochlu evam minachayim? Hahu amash ha'im bali arayas? Right? Yaakov achas men b'nei Noach mischayv v'miso. The brothers came and told Yaakov that the brothers were violating Arayus or Eivor Menachai or what have you. All things that would be subject to the death penalty among b'nei Noach. So b'nei Noach who violates any of the Shiva Mitzvahs b'nei Noach is subject to the death penalty. So he was an aid trying to implicate them in ways that were false. Uven Noach ne'erag l'fi eid echor b'lo eid. Uvelo asro v'al eid etzakrovim. And the halacha is that if a single aid who's a ben, you know, in ben Noach courts, a single aid who's a karov, who's a relative, can be believed with his testimony. Somebody could be put to death on the virtue, on the, you know, the strength of the testimony of one person who could be a relative. Asher al kein donu bal mishpat eizom turim hem edina shomayi. Right? So they treated him, they considered him to be an eizom because his accusations were false. And as an Eid Zomein who was trying to impose the death penalty upon them, so now, because he was giving false testimony, by the laws of Eid Zomein, the death penalty will boomerang back upon him. Therefore, they felt that they were justified in killing him. Turim hem edinei shamayim. Aye, so why did they try to arrange it that they were potter edinei adam? Because after all, if they're really right, so they don't have anything to worry about. They're not culpable for anything. But in this case, there was no hazama, meaning an eid zomim can't be rendered an eid zomim just because you know that he's lying. You need, you know, aid them to come along and say you couldn't have given that testimony because you were in a different place. So there were no mizimim, there were no aidim to render a Yosef an eid zomim. That's why they sought to kill him in a way where there would be no technical death penalty b'day adam. Right? And in Dinei Shamayim they were also exempt because, you know, objectively they knew that he was trying to subject them to the death penalty and that he was wrong, that he had misjudged their actions. Right? In the end of the day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was certainly manipulating the brothers in order to cause God's plan to be carried out over here. But they, from their perspective, felt justified, however wrongly, but they were they felt justified in, you know, what they were trying to do to him.
The thing is, who was going to
execute that? Right. Yeah. So again, it's hard to imagine that would actually be carried out because that would have been carried out already, right? I mean, I guess, you know, it's hard to imagine Yaakov Avinu just wholesale execution of all of his kids. Hard to contemplate.
Also, this seems like kind of like fluid explanation that the sort of concept of consciously. They felt they were doing a guitar against Yosef, but unconsciously their own negative feelings influenced them to be not so objective as they thought they were being.
Yeah, I know. I think you could definitely say that. Meaning, you know, even great people, you know, have to be aware that they have negios, that they have personal things that are motivating them. So whereas in their own minds they might have seen themselves as carrying out a din Torah, and were justified, but in the end of the day, you know, they didn't realize themselves how much the sinna and the kinna was really a motivating factor behind everything that we're doing. So this is the Ara Chaim trying to find, again, a justification, a halacha, for the din that the Shvatim were trying to be done, Yosef HaTzadik, and again, it gives us the sense of balance. He's right, and they're right, you know, everyone's coming with the best of intentions, but again, in the end of the day, even with the best of intentions, you end up having the kind of tragic events, you know, that play themselves out of the Pasha. As Hashem will pick up next week with Pashas Mikings.
Thank you.